Our topic for this session is reform in Renaissance Spain, and I think in the general context of the 16th Century Studies Conference, the session represents a sort of expansion of the 16th century historical consciousness. There was a time, perhaps it still is, and there certainly is an orientation of the 16th century as beginning in 1517, perhaps 1509, and ending somewhere in the 1590s, centering on we all know what. Now, and fairly recently, the concept of the long 16th century has come into historical consciousness, and it's probably a net gain, although some historical alchemists have seen the 16th century turning from gold to iron. The chronological stretching of the 16th century seems to allow for an enrichment of the conceptual significance of the century. And while religion still occupies an irremovable center of historical concerns in the 16th century, there are a lot of additional new items of interest at the epicenter. I think our papers today represent some of the steps in this direction. Both deal with Spain in the Golden Age, or if I may make an editorial comment after having read them, when the Golden Age was indeed beginning perhaps to turn to iron in Spain. Both are conceptually broad, and both bring to the end of the 16th century and even the beginning of the 17th century the Renaissance, which used to be tucked back toward the beginning of the 16th century. Well, with that, we'll proceed to the papers. The first is by Professor Michael Gordon of Denison University. Professor Gordon did his graduate work at the University of Chicago. He's interested in various aspects of Spain in the early modern period, and he combines that interest with an interest in Renaissance political thought. He has a number of publications in the Bibliothèque d'Humanisme et Renaissance, in the Journal of Modern History, and elsewhere. He's currently a postdoctoral fellow interesting himself in legal studies at Yale. And today he's going to talk to us on the methodology of reform in Renaissance Spain. Professor Gordon.
It is most appropriate to speak of reform at a conference devoted to 16th century studies. But the specific topic of this panel, reform in Renaissance Spain, is appropriate only if the expressions 16th century and reform are expanded beyond their usual meanings. If the first is used in the sense of Braudel's long 16th century, and thus to include the early 17th century, and if reform is used to describe a movement not directed primarily towards the reform of religious institutions. This panel is devoted to the ultimately unsuccessful movement for the reform of the Spanish monarchy in the early 17th century, and this paper to the methodology contained within this movement towards reform. It will deal specifically with three reformers who were active in the 1620s, the early years of the reign of King Philip IV and his favorite, the Conde Duque de Olivares. These three are Pedro Fernández Navarrete, a chaplain connected to the royal court, Sancho de Moncada, a professor of theology at the University of Toledo, and Miguel Caja de Laruela, an official in the royal bureaucracy. It will not deal with the specific proposals of these three reformers, for they varied from individual to individual, reflecting the particular circumstances of each man, and were, moreover, a response to the particular situation within Spain itself in the early 17th century. Thus, they are somewhat unique. Rather, this paper will look at the methodology of these men, the process by which they arrived at their specific proposals. For these men shared a common methodology which transcended their individual proposals, and such a methodology may have parallels with other movements for reform in the preceding century and a half. The Spanish reformers paid relatively little attention to the implementation of their reform proposals. They did, however, put a great emphasis upon approach. Each argued at great length about the validity of his own proposal, the correctness of his own methodology, and the confusion and error underlying the proposals and methodologies of others. Each was convinced that he, and he alone, was correctly using the science of politics, a science which, when correctly used, would lead to the identification of the real problems of Spain, and then to the determination of the appropriate solutions to these problems. The existence of a science of politics was assumed by the reformers, and the subject of this science was the state. To them, the state was something more than the king and the various institutions of the country. It was a distinct entity, a political unit which transcended its component parts. As such, it was an object which required careful attention, manipulation, and guidance by the king and or the king's counselors. Thus, for example, the reformers used the old metaphor of the body politic not to stress the interdependence of the component parts, but rather to stress the role of the king as physician to the body, a body which had become ill and required attention. Similarly, the metaphor of the ship of state was used not to emphasize the common purpose and unity of passengers sharing a journey, but to emphasize the role of the pilot, a man who anticipated dangers and took adequate precautions to guide the ship around them. Accordingly, the science of politics could be compared, the reformers argued, with the sciences of navigation and of medicine. All three sciences shared a concern for the prevention of possible dangers and, if danger was already present, the isolation of its causes and the discovery of its remedies. What exactly, then, was the science of politics as viewed and used by the reformers? To answer this question, it is necessary to distinguish between what the reformers said they were doing and what their actual procedure was. In theory, and I reiterate, in theory, there existed certain principles, principles which transcended particular circumstances and were to be found in all political bodies. Thus, for example, Sancho de Moncada argued the task of the student of politics, in other words, the reformer, was to learn these principles, these general laws of politics. Then, keeping these principles in mind, he would look at the contemporary situation, isolate the true problems and the causes thereof. Finally, and only as the last step, he would set forth the appropriate course of action for the state to take. This final step would be the discovery of the specific proposal that would be, in Moncada's words, useful, easy, proven, and just. Thus, for example, the logical argument of Leruela, an official of the Mesa, the Guild of Castilian Sheep Raisers, was that he had discovered the certain principle that livestock was the basis of all prosperity. He then demonstrated that the problems of Spain emanated from a lack of livestock. Finally, he set forth the appropriate solution, the restoration of the Mesa's power and privileges. A similar logic can be found in the other reformers. In Navarrete, for example, the general principle that the cost of monarchy be distributed over all the provinces of the state was learned from history. Castile was not adhering to this principle, and it should. The process of reasoning was, in theory, both inductive and deductive. General principles were to be drawn by a process of induction from the study of history. Then, the specific proposals were to be drawn by a process of deduction from these general principles. Such, then, was the theory, and usually the books of the reformers were structured accordingly. But in practice, their actual reasoning was quite different. Their major concern was not, in fact, the discovery of general principles which could be applied, in Leruela's words, to all customs and all times. Rather, their major concern was the isolation of the true causes of the problems they saw in Spain. And general principles served primarily as a rhetorical device. To illustrate, there was general agreement about the nature of the problems facing Spain. In one combination or another, everybody came up with the same thing: poverty, depopulation, sloth, and idleness. There was not, however, agreement about the causes of these problems. For example, Navarrete traced many problems back to the existence and proliferation of government annuities. Moncada agreed that government annuities were a problem, but not the real one, which he traced back to the place occupied by foreigners in the economy. Leruela traced everything, both the proliferation of annuities and the role of foreigners, back to the lack of livestock. clearly individual background and preference played a significant role in their determinations. Thus, it is obvious how Rauwera's long experience in the Mesa led to his stressing the value of abundant livestock. Similarly, Moncada's preoccupation with the economic role of foreigners was, at least in part, a reflection of the economic situation within his home city of Toledo. The preoccupation, then, of the reformers was in establishing the correct causal relationship. Moncada did this by a process of elimination. Many of the causes alleged by others were discounted as not being of recent origin. The problems facing Spain were recent, so the causes must be recent as well. Thus, he argued, the true causes of Spanish depopulation, a problem all were concerned with, could not be the expulsion of the Moors in 1609, it could not be the many wars, it could not be the great number of clergy. Spain had always expelled Moors, fought wars, and had many clergy. The existence of these factors was older than the depopulation, which was recent. As the effect was of recent origin, so too must be the cause, which again he found in the position occupied by foreigners. Now, once the correct cause had been established, it was then elevated to the stature of a law of politics, a general principle. And examples from history were invoked to substantiate and corroborate the principle. Thus, for Moncada, Roman history showed the deleterious effect of allowing foreigners to dominate an economy. For Rauwera, Roman history demonstrated the value of abundant livestock. History, then, was used as an authority to give testimony to the universal validity of the principle which had been discovered in the particular circumstances of Spain. Obviously, then, examples were chosen to fit circumstances, and there was little need for consistency. The reformers' use of history, the logical process through which they arrived at their general principles, was essentially not inductive at all. What conclusions, then, may be drawn about their methodology? Their approach, first of all, was secular. For the reformers, the problems of Spain were secular in origin. Although they did occasionally speak of God rewarding Spain for its virtue or God punishing Spain for its vice, these statements were rhetorical in nature and served exhortative functions. If we will do something, then we may trust God that Spain will prosper. The emphasis was always on our doing something and not on trusting God. Thus, in commenting on the reforms which the Council of Castile had proposed in 1619, Navarrete wrote, and I quote him, "We should trust God that by implementing that which the Council proposed for the universal good of the kingdom, the health and strength which we had a few years ago will be recovered very quickly." The secular outlook of the reformers also predominates in their view of history, which was exclusively explained in secular terms. Various explanations, of course, were given by various men for Rome's greatness. For example, its attachment to rural virtues, its wise policy of encouraging immigration. And various explanations were given for Rome's decline. For example, its loss of rural virtue, its unwise policy of encouraging immigration. But underneath these explanations was an implicit acceptance of a secular view of historical causation. The history of Rome was not to be explained by the granting or withholding of God's favor, nor was the history of Spain to be so explained. Given what the reformers thought their method to be, it was only logical that they placed great importance upon the study of history. Navarrete argued on a number of occasions that for ministers and officers, a knowledge of history was essential. Moncada suggested that a new university be established, one devoted to the science of governing, and one in which the study of history would play an important and prominent role in the curriculum. Even though the reformers did not, in fact, use the study of history to discover general principles, their methodology does contain a sense of history, an awareness of historical change, and an identification of the present and the past. They perceived their own time as being one of change, and perceived the past similarly. Historical periods varied, and the needs of the state differed accordingly. Navarrete's discussion of the Spanish Empire, for example, was an attempt to demonstrate that Spain should act with the flexibility similar to that which the Church had adopted in recognizing the need to change at different times. Although primarily concerned with meeting the current needs of Spain, the reformers were well aware that these needs might not be the same as those of previous years. Although conscious of historical change, and indeed perhaps because they were conscious of historical change, the reformers were aware of a close relationship between the experiences of the past and those of the present. Certain past ages were similar to the present situation, and the present could best be seen with reference to the past. Navarrete thus could identify the Council of Castile with the Senate of Republican Rome, and accordingly interpret Ciceronian statements on the Senate as being applicable to the Council. King Philip IV of Spain, who was being exhorted to make meaningful reforms, could be another Cato. Indeed, the two situations were so similar that the two men could even share the same epitaph. The perception of parallels between the experiences of the past and those of the present enabled the reformers to use history in their analysis of the problems of Spain. Although their use of history was not clearly what they thought it to be, their methodology nevertheless had an historical dimension. A final conclusion that may be made about the methodology of the reformers is that it was utilitarian. Their general principles, though not arrived at by the inductive methods they thought they were using, were employed and evaluated not in terms of the morality of the actions prescribed, but in terms of the efficiency and efficacy of such actions. The primary criterion used by the reformers was utility. This secular, pragmatic approach is nowhere clearer than in their use of reason of state, raison d'état. The reformers used the phrase reason of state in three different senses. Typically, the phrase was used as a general principle, a rule of statecraft, one that transcended individual circumstances and was universally applicable. Moncada, thus, arguing against the export of iron, wrote that it is an, and I quote him, indispensable reason of state, not only to arm oneself, but to disarm the enemy. A second usage, but rather rare, was to use the term for the actual science of governing. Thus, Moncada wrote that government, or reason of state, is the method of founding, maintaining, or increasing a kingdom. A third usage, also infrequent, was as a rationale for a specific action. Navarrete thus stated that the Romans justified their rape of the Sabine women with the reason of state of increasing their population. Reason of state encompasses all three of these usages, but both of the latter meanings are implicit in the first usage. Reason of state, as a general principle, was the rationale for a specific action. The systematic arrangement and study of these general principles was the science of politics. Simply, reason of state was a rule of statecraft. A distinction was often drawn between a good reason of state and a bad reason of state. For example, Navarrete contrasted the good reason of state that the people should love the king with the bad reason of state that the people should fear the king. An individual reason of state was good because of two factors. On the one hand, the action it outlined was in conformity with divine law and thus was moral. On the other hand, the action was also good because it worked, because it maintained and improved the state. There were some cases in which both factors were operative, but the emphasis of the reformers was usually on the latter criterion. It was a good reason of state that the people should love their king. If they did so, the state would prosper. Very rarely was abstract morality invoked to prove the goodness of a reason of state. Rather, utility, as demonstrated through reference to history, was used. Conversely, a reason of state was bad because the action it prescribed was immoral, and even more, because such action would not be helpful to the state. If the people feared the king, the state would suffer. Again, utility, as demonstrated by historical reference, could be relied upon to demonstrate the poorness of a reason of state. The absence of moral justification should not, however, be interpreted as an attempt by the reformers to divorce moral considerations from political ones. Moral precepts and political efficacy were, in their minds, not, and indeed could not be, in conflict with each other. Politically effective principles would be morally proper. Moral actions would be politically effective. The criterion for establishing the goodness or badness of a reason of state were both moral and political, and these two criteria were not mutually exclusive. The general tendency, however, of the reformers was to mention political considerations explicitly and to treat moral factors only implicitly, if at all. The primary criterion, then, which the reformers used to evaluate both their general principles and the actions prescribed by them with efficacy, the utility of such actions for the state. What general conclusion, then, may be drawn about the methodology of the reformers? While their method was not what they themselves believed it to be, while they did not discover and utilize a systematic set of universal principles, it still was one of rational analysis. The science of politics, as viewed and as used by the reformers of early 17th century Spain, was secular, historical, and utilitarian. Whether it was scientific depends, of course, on one's definition of science. If the term scientific is to be bestowed only upon a purely objective, inductive, and empirical approach, then the methodology of the reformers certainly was not scientific. If, however, the term may be bestowed upon an approach which, in observing phenomenon, attempts to analyze the phenomena, to discover discrete components, and to distinguish causal relationships, and does so by the use of reason without reference to myth or the supernatural, then it may be said that the methodology of reform in early 17th century Spain was indeed a scientific one. Finally, to return to a point I made at the beginning of this paper, I should like to raise the issue again of the appropriateness of a topic such as this in a conference such as the one in which we are now participating. While the problems which confronted Western Europe in the first half of the 17th century were generally unique to that period of time, while the specific proposals which were put forward by the Spanish reformers to deal with these problems were reactions to particular Spanish circumstances, the methodology by which these problems were confronted and these proposals were determined may not have been that unique. I should like to finish by raising the question of the extent to which that somewhat vague but always tangible movement known as the Renaissance provided Europeans with a common set of assumptions, priorities, and techniques, a common methodology with which they approached the many reforms of the long 16th century.
Thank you, Professor Gordon. The second speaker is Professor Theodore Corbett of Florida State University. Professor Corbett did his graduate work, receiving a PhD from the University of Southern California. He has an interest in Spanish social and cultural history in the early modern period. He has articles in the Journal of the History of Ideas and elsewhere. And today he's going to talk to us on a godly discipline in the Counter-Reformation, Puritanism of Reformers in Renaissance Spain.
I haven't changed it completely. You always are allowed to change your title a little, I think. A Godly Discipline in Renaissance Spain, Neo-Stoicism as a Basis of Puritanism. Puritanism is one of those terms which has immediate recognition in any scholarly community. To most of us, the term brings to mind the Puritan ethic, originated by our English ancestors and then carried to America, where it was fundamental in establishing the moral values of our nation. Max Weber was the father of the Puritan ethic as a historical idea, claiming that the ethic was created during the Reformation by ascetic Protestants, and that application of the ethic to social conduct had a decisive effect in creating the capitalistic spirit necessary for the development of modern society. Since the publication of Religion and the Rise of Capitalism more than 60 years ago, Weber's thesis has become a part of history, being constantly debated and revised so that literally every line of his work is controversial. So that there will be no misunderstanding, this paper depends for its information about the Puritan ethic on Weber's above work and two recent accounts of 16th and 17th century English Puritanism, Michael Walzer's The Revolution of the Saints and David Little's Religion, Order, and Law. Thus, it is my object to accept the Puritan ethic not only in terms of the master of the subject, but his latest descendants. The fundamental aim of this paper is to keep much of the Weberian ideological content of the Puritan movement. But to set the term Puritan free from its traditional ties to the Reformation, Calvinism, and Anglo-American capitalism and liberalism. Devastating as such a move might be construed, it has been suggested before by Michael Walzer in his study of English Puritanism, when he wrote, "The saints," referring to English Puritans, "are likely to be similar, not to the men who came before or after them in English history, but to other men in other countries who lived through a similar time and shared some of the same experiences. It is my intention to define Puritanism in a broad sense, so as to make it a phenomena of a Catholic South European society in the later 16th and early 17th centuries. Derived from Weber, my definition of Puritanism will be the ideal of practicing a worldly asceticism, or organizing a secular community according to the rules of a godly discipline. The subject of my study will be the attempt to create a worldly asceticism in late Renaissance Spain." The existence of Puritanism in Renaissance Spain has been touched upon previously by Hugh Trevor Roper in his famous essay, The General Crisis of the 17th Century. In this and other essays, Trevor Roper argues that in the 1620s, and I might point out, of course, what, in the late Renaissance, let's say, just to spill over, a trend towards Puritanism developed, not only in England, but on a European-wide scale, including Spain. Trevor Roper defends his Puritanism a bit more loosely than I have, as non-doctrinal, moral Puritanism that created a new attitude of mind, emphasizing a set of values called the country mentality. The values of the country mentality represent the application of moral principles to social conduct to produce a society based upon simplicity of dress and lifestyle, a respect for the occupation of husbandry, frugality in the management of expenses, and a desire for local control over tax revenues and affairs. The Puritanism of the country mentality was brought about by negative reaction to the creation of Renaissance courts in 16th century Europe, with their extravagant artistic endeavors, expanding bureaucracy, and frivolous expenditure of revenue, often on foreign adventures. The conflict between court and country mentalities in Spain, as well as England, led figures of the country mentality to develop Puritanism that aimed at protest and reform. To further clarify the relationship between a country mentality and Puritanism, it should be made evident that they were not synonymous. To be a Puritan, more than holding a certain values or criticism of existing institutions, was necessary. Puritanism inspired one to reform and change in practical terms, so that it necessitated plans applicable to the organizing of communities and societies. As an example of the line one might draw between a figure of the country mentality and an ideological Puritan, the words of a familiar Reformation leader are enlightening. Martin Luther possessed a country mentality when he wrote, and I quote, "If 95% of the papal court were abolished and only 1% were left, it would still be large enough to deal with questions of Christian faith." He's referring, admittedly, to the Pope. "The Pope has more than 3,000 secretaries alone, and no one can count the others he employs, as the posts are so numerous. It is hardly possible to number all those that lie in wait for the institutions and benefices of Germany, like wolves for sheep. Some have estimated that more than 300,000 guilders go annually from Germany to Rome, quite uselessly and to no purpose, while we get nothing in return except contempt and scorn. It is not at all astonishing if princes, aristocracy, towns, institutions, country, and people grow poor." End quote. Despite these phrases in support of the country mentality, it is well known that Luther was not a Puritan, but rather a political quietist, depending upon the action of the individual conscience, hostile to the secular reform of society to achieve religious goals. It was the propensity for direct action in worldly affairs which carried Spanish reformers from a mere country mentality to the ideology of Puritanism. In Spain, a spirit of godly discipline in worldly affairs had developed among the religious leaders in the late Middle Ages, and then in the 16th century was carried by mendicant orders to the New World. The religious orders were particularly adept at creating secular communities in frontier territories open to the development in the Iberian Peninsula by the Reconquest, and in America by the zeal to convert the natives. They who recognized such Christian asceticism, but he felt that it was elitist and otherworldly, stating unfairly that Calvin brought Christian asceticism into the marketplace. But in so little time, this topic cannot be pursued further. It is sufficient to remember that the religious orders in Spain did give an impetus to worldly asceticism. Admittedly, what I'm doing here is I'm dropping material. Besides, it is my intention to show that Spanish Puritanism received its greatest incentive from the classical and pagan sources of the Renaissance. In reality, the rise of Renaissance humanism in 16th century Spain expanded the Puritan ideology to a wide spectrum of scholars, bureaucrats, diplomats, and military commanders who were instrumental in applying Puritan ideas to Spanish society. Contrary to Trevor Roper's emphasis on the corrupting influence of Renaissance values and the views of at least one scholar on Calvinist Puritanism, Renaissance humanism had much to do with the creation and spread of Puritanism, at least in Spain. For our purpose of discovering Puritanism, the spread of Renaissance humanism in Spain concerns not only the popularity of Erasmus and Christian humanism, but most importantly, the respect for the historical and moral works of the classical world by authors like Plutarch, Seneca, Tacitus, Cicero, Livy, and Thucydides. These latter works gave Spaniards a view of moral conduct and social organization based upon Stoic philosophy and the example of leadership and statecraft in the Greek city-states and Rome, sources which formed the twin basis of Spanish Puritanism. The affinity between the ethics of Calvinist Puritanism and those of Stoic Puritanism has been touched upon before. Stoics emphasized the virtues of constancy, righteousness, modesty, prudence, and justice. Stoics also disdained the passions, pride, and excesses of pleasure and wealth. Certain Stoics like Tacitus and Seneca supported religious belief and pious conduct as a stable foundation on which to rest the state, so as not to eliminate religion as a basis for ordering society. The fundamental difference between Calvinists and Stoics has also been described. Stoics were passive participants in public life who did not destroy the traditional order of society in order to improve it. Rather, they sought virtue in doing their job well. In forming a godly discipline, Stoics could not be revolutionary like Calvinist saints. Yet what is often overlooked is that Stoics could advocate reform in a most militant way to maintain and preserve the old order. Reform was one of the many duties which enhanced the reputation and virtue of the Stoic Puritan. In an age of eclectic writing, Stoicism appeared not only in complete translations of classical works, but also in works of commentaries and maxims derived from them. For instance, Balthazar Alamos de Barrientos published in 1614 a Castilian translation of Tacitus, Tácito Español, which became more famous for the insights of the aphorisms and the maxims of statecraft that appeared in the margins of each page than for the translation itself. In Spain, the most important disseminator of developing neo-Stoicism and knowledge of classical society was from Northern Europe, a retiring Flemish humanist, Justus Lipsius, to the Spaniards Justo Lipsio. In the late 16th and early 17th century, a cult of Lipsius sprang up in Madrid, Seville, and the diplomatic centers of the Spanish Empire, embracing humanists like Arias Montaño, courtiers like García de Figueroa, literary figures like Francisco de Quevedo, diplomats like Bernardino de Mendoza, counselors like Baltasar Zengiwinga, and even Philip IV's favorite, the Count Duke of Olivares. Lipsius's reputation among Castile's leadership was based upon his Latin editions of Tacitus in 1575, his study of moral conduct, De Constantia, 1583, his insights into political life, Politicorum Libri Sex, 1589, and his work on the Roman military establishment, De Militia Romana. Members of the cult of Lipsius translated these works into Castilian, published them, and utilized the works as a basis for their own studies of statecraft. What impressed the members of the cult of Lipsius about their mentor was that Lipsius's writings taught one to lead a worldly life and still remain moral. The burden of leadership of the Counter-Reformation required Spaniards to perform the most aggressive and sophisticated statecraft to sustain the Catholic world. Just as Calvinists adopted the same techniques to support their godly commonwealths. Thus, it was a major concern of Spaniards to harmonize the pagan and Machiavellian origins of such statecraft with Catholic religious values. In answer to this need, Lipsius recommended the concept of prudence as a guide to carry individuals through the pitfalls and dangers of public life. The ultimate aims of prudence were not in terms of politics, but rather constancy and piety, a godly moral basis on which an individual or community might flourish. Several attributes were required to be constant and pious while making political decisions. One first had to examine the teachings of experience and history in a disciplined, rational manner, which emphasized total detachment from worldly confusion and conflict. A follower of the cult of Lipsius was thus called upon to be trained in the ways of the world and yet remain steadfast and aloof from them in making decisions which had to reflect piety. The key to this process was the firmness of one's conscience, the point at which secular decision-making was tied to the influence of divine providence. Once this state of discipline was reached, a statesman might use dissimulation, naked force, or the most underhanded means to maintain his own virtue or that of his community. Like his Calvinist brethren, the Neo-Stoic was called upon to discipline his own life so that he could enforce his moral views in worldly affairs. Calvinist magistrates had placed an emphasis upon the need to regulate and regimentalize moral values within society. The equivalent of the Calvinist magistrate in Lipsius's works was the office of Roman censor. As a reformer, Lipsius urged the creation of censors on the Roman model to regulate taxes and markets, to restore faith in religion, and to prevent all forms of excess in wealth, lust, drunkenness, quarrels, banquets, apparel, and other finery. Here was an office of the highest moral virtue with wide powers to organize and reform society for godly prosperity, an office based upon the need to cleanse society of sin and disorder, but of course, in a sense, an office with a pagan origin. As the cult of Lipsius spread, Spain also suffered grave economic and political difficulties. The story of the decline of Spain in the 17th century is well known and will not be told here. What is important is that Spaniards did not simply endure the decline of Spain and their empire. A reform movement developed in the late 16th and early 17th centuries in Spain as humanists, lawyers, municipal and royal officials created reforming plans called arbitros. These reformers, or arbitristas, were interested in ordering Spanish society so that the decline could be prevented. This crisis led many reformers to develop Neo-Stoic moral values as a basis for political and social reform. Spanish Puritanism thus owed its existence to an attempt to rediscover and reassert moral values that had brought greatness to the Spanish Empire in the past. Today, the importance of ethical and moral reform in solving political, social, and economic problems may seem anachronistic and often foolhardy. But in the Renaissance period, reform required an ordering of society in such a way that its members would be morally uplifted and consequently prosper. To the Spanish reformers, the subject of decline was diagnosed in the terms of growing vice, sloth, excessive wealth, or overweening pride, qualities which caused the decline of empires. The reformers wanted the Spanish monarchy to enforce high moral standards to rid society of such vice, and to inspire ordered, efficient, pious, and frugal conduct as a basis for reform. Several aspects of the arbitros produced by the reformers show the influence of neo-Stoic Puritanism, and from these I have picked a few examples. One problem seen by the reformers in terms of moral corruption concerned the development of a picaresque attitude among Spanish youth, who were reputedly growing as rootless and lazy as the characters in the novels of that type. Picaresque attitudes contrasted markedly with the portrayals of rigorous and disciplined youth found in Plutarch's account of Sparta's supposed lawgiver Lycurgus, or Livy's description of the Roman Republic, works that were translated into Castilian in the 15th and 16th centuries. As the reformers saw it, the problem with the development of picaresque attitudes was not so much a fault of the instruction of education as the social mobility caused by the attainment of education. On the subject, Alfonso de Barros, Philip III's chamberlain, wrote a commentary on the famous story found in Plutarch of how Lycurgus raised two puppies, the one to chase hares in true Spartan style, and the other to lap milk degenerately. Barros urged reform when he noted that without the curb of their parents and prudent education, they, and he was referring to the younger generation, rush into the career of their youth upon the unbridled horse of their irrational, untamed passions, which carry them away headlong and causes a thousand inconveniences, dashing themselves on so many rocks till there is not one bone left unbroken, nor limb which is not stripped of life and goods. Barros went on to note that too many sons were switching from the professions of their fathers and going to grammar schools, a training for which they were neither suited nor needed. 20 years later, the idleness of the younger generation was also criticized in Vargas Machuca's Teoria Exercicios de Gineta, Primores Secretos y Advertencias Dea. In Spartan fashion, Machuca condemned youth for traveling only in coaches instead of the rigorous saddle which prepared one for a military career. Complaints like these were taken to heart by the counselors in Madrid, who, when appointed to create a reforming program, did not hesitate to intervene into educational affairs to mold youth in the Spartan tradition. In 1619, the Madrid Council of State dealt with part of the problem of the younger generation by suggesting that the number of grammar schools be reduced, particularly to prevent young peasants from leaving the depopulated countryside to become scribes and teachers. I guess that was a problem even then. The Council of State's proposal became the basis for a law outlined in the Capitulos of 1623, which forbade the granting of licenses to scribes for a period of 5 years in an effort to reduce the number of grammar schools. As to the rest of the problem concerning the number of youths riding in coaches, a law of 1611 ordered licensing of coaches, limited the officials allowed to ride in them, and to prod the idle youths, it required all able-bodied men to ride horseback. In sum, the monarchy did not hesitate to regulate Spanish society so that Castilian youth would maintain the occupation of their fathers and exercise themselves in preparation to bear arms. The needs of war against Protestants and Turks required social austerity on the part of Spaniards. Sumptuary reform, often based on classical models, was used by the Spanish monarchy to make society more frugal. In the 1626 edition of Pedro Fernández Navarrete's Conservación de Monarquías, the reformer cited a speech by Cato the Elder to the Roman Senate, as found in Livy, as well as Tacitus, Aristotle, and Petrarch in condemning luxury in dress and in urging its regulation by the monarch. Of the various types of reforming legislation, sumptuary reform seems to have been the most popular. From the Count Duke of Olivares to the humblest arbitrista, all supported him. In the famous Capitulos of 1623, 14 of the 23 chapters were devoted to sumptuary reform, including restrictions on the number of servants in households, the size of dowries, and the quality of material used in buildings, hangings, trimmings, apparel, silk materials, and collars. To set an example of pious austerity, the royal household was to limit the dowries of the ladies of the court to the amount that that had been in the time of Philip II, and I might say it wasn't too much. Avowedly, the basic aim of the legislation was to adopt for Spaniards the dress of their enemies, the Dutch, a society which is often considered the prototype of Calvinist Puritanism. Of course, the effort of Spanish reformers and the Habsburg monarchy to apply a godly discipline to Castilian society did not completely conform to the Calvinist or Weberian idea of Puritanism. A major difference can be seen when one evaluates the success of the Castilian reform movement. In Spain, only the reformers and royal counselors adopted the Puritan ethic, while the average Castilian was not willing to accept the regimentation and self-sacrifice of Puritanism. Even the support of Puritanism by the court and the royal administration was half-hearted. For example, the legislation to limit the crush of coaches in Madrid was first subverted by the counselors, secretaries, ambassadors, and members of the royal household who easily obtained exemptions. Sumptuary reform fared little better in its enforcement. A month after the promulgation of the Capitulos of 1623, Charles, the Prince of Wales, made a surprise visit to Madrid in search of a wife, and to entertain him, the enacted sumptuary laws were thrown to the winds. In Weberian terms, Spanish society lacked the self-confidence of a Calvinist society, whose members felt themselves to be a predestined elect. It is my suspicion, however, that the weakness of the Habsburg monarchy in enforcing the Puritan laws was the result of too much respect for local and corporate privilege. The Habsburg monarchy was, frankly, too weak to bring about changes in social conduct in Renaissance Spain. In contrast, Calvinist Geneva, the New England town, and other Puritan congregations were more successful in enforcing a godly discipline, because of their societies were more compact and homogeneous. Rarely larger than a city-state, the Calvinist commonwealths had a sense of community cohesion. In Spain, such community cohesion and civic spirit was still strong on a local level, among the municipalities that participated in the Castilian Cortes. But it was not an attitude easily transferred to the Spanish Empire or to the Habsburg family, and the bulk of Spanish society lacked the moral and civic cohesion necessary for Puritan values to be successfully enforced. One last characteristic of the Puritanism of the Castilian reform movement must also be noted. The Puritan ethic of the Castilian reformers had little influence over remedies for the economic problems of Spain and the empire. In general, the individual motives of capitalism were subverted for the basic good of the community. If supply and demand economics were applied to problems, it was by the scholastic doctors at Salamanca. The neo-stoicism of Lipsius taught one how to carry out wars, how to gain diplomatic triumphs, how to discipline and enforce laws within a society, how to maintain internal stability. But it did not provide what we would call economic remedies for problems. This lack of understanding of economic problems can easily be traced to the classical sources of the reformers, for they were equally deficient in their treatment of what we call economics. Thus, Castilian Puritanism dealt with the political and social organizing of society while ignoring economic needs. I am left with the feeling that I have quite unintentionally placed another nail in the coffin of the famous Weber thesis. Puritanism appeared in Catholic Spain at the same time as it did in Protestant England, stimulated by humanist studies of neo-stoicism rather than Calvinist theology. Though not as successful as the Puritanism of Northern Europe, Spanish Puritanism did provide a measure of security for Spanish society caught in the crisis of decline. This is certainly not the Weber thesis, but it does suggest that his concept for practicing a worldly asceticism was considered fundamental to the preservation of Renaissance and early modern societies. Thank you.
Well, we have ample time for questions, or the amplitude, I guess, will remain to be seen. Anybody have any questions of either speaker?
I can understand the use of the term Puritanism as you've used it, but I really don't see much of Weber in it. And it seems to me that a basic contradiction here lies in the fact that the Protestant ethic instead of the Puritan ethic, the Protestant ethic, as Weber talks about it, is really a negative ethic, a liberating ethic, it seems to me, which is, as he said, a light cloak, which frees you for participation in a world. And this is similar to the kind of theosophism you were talking about, but I don't think it's the same, since what you're talking about in stream is social political reform, things which were essentially irrelevant, I think, to the carriers of the Protestant ethic as it goes into the spirit of capitalism, and Weber talks about it. And for Weber, it seems to me the Protestant ethic is a negative ethic in a sense. The reform you're talking about seems to me to be very positive in the sense that they're socially orientated, they're reactionary, they're progressive in a reform sense, but they're not radically negative, they're positive.
I, of course, you can see right away, I'm not saying it is the Weber ethic, and I'm putting emphasis on the term Puritanism, and furthermore, on the definition of what I would say worldly asceticism, which is, in a sense, only part of what Weber says, and I was trying to make that somewhat clear. The two books I mentioned, however, at the beginning, tend to take what I would say the Puritanism of England, and definitely part to what I would call, in fact, revolutionary social reform in the case of Michael Wilder. Now, of course, you can say you can eliminate it, but at least it has been said that Puritanism was literally revolutionary and terribly secular, much more secular, quite frankly, than the Spanish reformers, who, as you can see, are the key thing I think to note is that they would have considered themselves revitalizing something that already existed, trying to revitalize older values. I basically, I can see this. One, of course, immense problem with doing a study like this is what is the Weber thesis? Oh my goodness, literally, you can imagine how many books could be written on it. So you're in a little bit of difficulty. But the thing that simply struck me was that worldly asceticism was existing in a Catholic country at this time. Maybe not in quite exactly the same form, but very similar. And of course, the other thing being the basis, I found a very strong basis in the classical tradition as opposed to any form of religious tradition.
Yes.
I was questioning the attempt to tie all of this in with Puritanism. In the first place, it's very difficult. I'm not sure whether you use Walter's definition or any one of a great number of definitions of Puritanism, but no one really readily agrees what Puritanism actually is and how one can define it. And it's already a confusing enough term. And if the historians either in English history or in 17th century New England could avoid using the term, they probably would, and they're arguing over it. And to me, it makes your paper rather nebulous. It's almost like perhaps a Mencken type of definition of Puritanism. In other words, meaning very strict dress. Well, in New England, of course, it's long been known that they were not that strict necessarily in their dress. They didn't wear somber, dark colors and such things as this. They were somewhat strict in certain respects, like the drama and things like that. But it seems to me you're kind of welding together, if you talk about neo-Stoicism, the ancient classical Stoic tradition, with that of Puritanism. I'm still somewhat at a loss as to why you're trying to tie this in with the definition of Puritanism.
Well, again, I simply refer you, for example, David Little spends a great deal of time trying to separate Stoicism from Puritanism. I mean, other scholars have done this. I That's why I put a great deal of emphasis in the beginning upon the book. You know specifically what I'm talking about. That would be my basic reaction. I'm sort of accepting their definitions, if you want to put it this way. Admittedly, no one else is right now. I wouldn't go any further. I will say what I also am trying to do is explain the motivations for a reform movement in Spanish society. And I find that I'm explaining this admittedly to an audience of Americans, and this might be a way of explaining it. It comes closer than anything else, or a thing I do about it.
Hold on.
A number of French authors of this being curious, quite a bit of solicitation, Montaigne, Pierre Charron, those who have, and these writings have been written saying the possible minor rivulet of solicitation.
And Calvin, I would add. Calvin very definitely got a great deal of Seneca. I mean, Calvin read Stoicism, so, okay, there's a connection there. I'm not
Calvin
sure.
Read the
what?
Calvin
wouldn't have been read. Now, Calvin, I said, was influenced by Stoicism. That's the tie there. My reaction would be, I don't know, I guess I don't know, Michael, but my reaction would be no, although at least in the case of Montaigne, I really don't know of any translations right away that came in. But there is no reason why this isn't a parallel movement going on in France as well as in Spain at this time.
How did the Inquisition and the Index of Forbidden Books look upon Lipsius?
He was immensely popular. Now, I should, of course, point out what one thing Lipsius does do with these Stoic works is he synthesizes them with what you would call Catholic theology and with Counter-Reformation theology. So in a sense, what he is doing is making it perfectly acceptable for you to practice Machiavellian statecraft by sugarcoating it, you might say, although he wouldn't have considered it that way, with a great deal of good Catholic theology. This is a lot better than using someone like Machiavelli, who obviously is condemned by the Inquisition and is on the index. And admittedly, I've written a whole article on the cult of Lipsius, and I didn't go into immense detail on the connection between the political figures of this time, but it was a very popular group, apparently, and as mentioned, it's called usually the cult of Lipsius, as being a very prominent school of political and reformist thought.
Yes, in the back.
Again, for Mr. Carbett, I wonder if, at the level of hypothesis, there is not perhaps a distinction to be made in speaking about just interworldly aestheticism, to use that term. It seems to me that in Weber's discussion of what he takes to be an interworldly aestheticism, the function of economic, in a sense, in other words, Weber's concerned about the relaxation of what he takes to be religious restraints of accumulation of capital, mm-hmm. and certain kinds of attitudes for making money. And some of the other literature in the same school, I find there's a great deal of focus on preaching related to the problem of business life and so forth. But I think what you're talking about would be, at a very theoretical level, a kind of interworldly aestheticism related not to the uses of wealth, but to the uses of power.
It's more political and social in orientation, of course, as I point out at the end. On the other hand, this is what Rouse's book, for example, does do. I don't want to depend on him so much, but many people are now accepting the theory as basically in terms of a political theory and the organization of society and economics only being peripheral. We've got to remember that when we talk about these terms, people did not understand economics the way we do. It wasn't the dismal science yet. There really was no economics, at least in terms, and they would have thought of it, frankly, in moral terms. And therefore, and politics as well, they would really have integrated completely. Economic, moral, social conduct would have all been integrated under the heading of morality.